welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled Rebel Yelling, The State of Adults in America. The date is March 2024, and my name is A.D. Tippett. And before we get to the podcast, I would just ask you to check out all of our podcasts. We have over 200 of them on all manner of history, across all eras, across all nations. I also post this on Substack, along with some short-form essays. And finally, I am published in the Freeman newsletter. It's an excellent newsletter with a whole array of writers who talk in terms of pure conservatism. Please check that out. And now, on to the podcast. At the core of liberalism, or progressivism, is the spoiled child. Miserable as all spoiled children are, unsatisfied, demanding, ill-disciplined, despotic, and useless. Liberalism is a philosophy of sniveling brats. P.J. O'Rourke. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. Paul of Tarsus. Every generation tends to disparage the one that comes after as it ages. Though the following quote may not have been from an ancient source, it predates our era and was probably written in 1907, certainly before 1940. The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in place of exercise. Children are now tyrants. Not the servants of the household. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, the whore, and tyrannize their teachers. And again, keep in mind, this was before 1940. In a fun piece by Joe Gillard entitled, The 2,500-Year-Old History of Adults Blaming the Younger Generation, the author provides a timeline of such lamentations. Here is Horace in the first century. Our sire's age was worse than our grandsire's. We, their sons, are more worthless than say, so in our turn we shall give the world a progeny yet more corrupt. Here's Thomas Barnes in the 17th century. Youth were never more saucy, yea, never more savagely saucy. The ancient are scorned, the honorable are contemned, the magistrate is not dreaded. And this from the 1930s. And I would keep in mind, this editorial from the Leeds Mercury talks about the silent generation, or Tom Brokaw's greatest generation. This would be the people who, you know, got through the Depression, won World War II, and matched up with the Soviets, eventually winning the Cold War. Parents themselves were often the cause of many difficulties. They frequently failed in their obvious duty to teach self-control and discipline to their children. Again, remember who we're talking about? Did the guys at Guadalcanal in Okinawa lack discipline? And maybe one generation does not spare the next one, but certainly the one after that. Boomers are trashing millennials to the point where the meme, "Okay, boomer," became a common rejoinder. And Xers, well, like me, wonder what the heck is wrong with the Zs. The recent 2024 State of the Union address made me ask what the matter is with the entire nation. It was infantilism from all generations. The evening began late because a group of pro-Hamas protesters decided to lie down in front of the president's motorcade. They clearly felt their cause was so worthy that they would disrupt the proceedings. And of course, as with all these performative exhibitions, the lives of their fellow citizens. Once there, you had Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene decked out with mega gear as if she had just hit the Panola Pines Plaza truck stop in Texas to get all of the good merch. Then you had a group of Democratic women cosplaying as suffragettes in support of abortion? Of course, none of these so-called adults could be bothered to learn that the real suffragettes, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, abhorred the practice of abortions. They called it murder. Then you had the squad, once clad in the suffragette white, but since Hamas murdered 1,200 Israelis, these belles of the ball were wearing pro-Palestinian blue. Was this a State of the Union address or the New York Village Halloween parade? It did not help that the Republican response, delivered by once rising star Alabama Senator Katie Britt, was delivered in such breathless tones that I wondered if she was a 15-year-old trying for the part of Blanche DuBois in the high school production of A Streetcar Named Desire. And the star of this grotesque demonstration of the unfitness of our leaders to lead a great nation? Well, that would be Silent Generation Joe Biden. Yes, he is so old, he predates the boomers. Forget the lies and half-truths exhibited throughout his presentation, or the Democrats are they're jumping up and down out of their seats like so many trained seals. Instead, Biden taunted the Republicans in a back and forth that was unworthy of both parties. Was this an update of the State of the Union or thuggish fans at a rugby match? Some thought incorrectly that Biden would bring adult behavior back to the White House after the term of his enfant's terrible predecessor. Yet Biden's petulance and taunting looked like a return to, let's go to the bike racks behind the school in fifth grade and settle it, the place of settling scores in my old Wisconsin home. In fairness, I despise the State of the Union address in its current P.T. Barnum iteration. Like the great Kevin Williamson, as he has said, it is imperial spectacle. One branch of the government, the first, according to that thing called the Constitution, does not stand in reverence for the other branch, but that's what happens at the State of the Union. Third, the judiciary does not need to be hectored in a public format. This travesty needs to be eliminated, and we cannot go back to POTUS sending a letter to Congress fast enough to suit me. That was the practice for 130 years until Woodrow Wilson, of course, ended it and began doing State of the Unions live in Congress. You see, if one takes a political position as the opposite of any Wilson policy, one will surely be on the right side of policy and morality. But regarding this State of the Union, I kept asking myself the same question. Where are the grown-ups? When Matt Gaetz, of all people, is clad in a sober suit and tie and is not yelling at the podium, and he is the one personifying adulthood, something is very, very wrong. So is this podcast an A.D. Tippett rant akin to, get off my lawn, you stinky kids? Well, there's always that possibility. After all, I was raised in the 1980s with big hair, Michael Jackson, and George Michael's Wham. Not exactly the stuff of the pioneers, Rough Riders, or storming Omaha Beach on D-Day. So who am I to talk? So instead of personal anecdotes, I'm going to look at some data and demographics. The first is the new propensity for children to be born not just out of wedlock, but into single-person homes. According to Pew Research, almost one quarter of U.S. children under 18 live with one parent and no other adults. That is up from 9%. Right now it's around 23%. That is up from 9% in 1960. And this is more than three times the share of children worldwide who do so. They live 7% are those who live in single-parent households outside of the United States. That stat, because it includes 18-year-olds, dates back to 2006. And compare this stat to our past and today. According to NPR, almost half of all babies born in the U.S. were born to unmarried women in 2019. Almost half. A dramatic increase since 1960, when only 5% of births went to unmarried mothers. And it's not just because of divorce. Today's unpartnered mothers are also more likely to have never been married. Now, is this healthy? In a work published in 2022 entitled The Power of the Two-Parent Home by Kevin DeYoung, the author states, the percentage of white children living in poverty goes from 31% in families with only a mother to 17% with only a father, all the way down to 5% in families with a married couple. In other words, that poverty rate goes up 6x from married couples to single parents. The same percentages for Black children go from 45% mother-only to 36% father-only to 12% married couple. Now, we can lament that Black children in two-parent families are still 2.4 times more likely to be in poverty than white children. Still something to look at. Still, we should also observe that white children raised by only a mother are 2.6 times as likely to be in poverty as Black children raised by two parents. We're talking 31% versus 12%. And even in families where the parents are not married, they are superior to one-person households. While it's well established that married parents are typically better off financially than unmarried parents, there are also differences in financial well-being among unmarried parents. For example, a much larger share of solo parents is living in poverty compared with cohabiting parents. Now note the massive increase in two parents but unmarried households, and yet the dichotomy between the success of these structures versus married ones. As I have argued vociferously over the years, two is better than one, but there is also an issue of impermanence. Unmarried tend to switch partners or go periods without any partner. Because marriage is seen as unnecessary to many today, those who do commit tend to commit for the long term. So there is a clear hierarchy of success: married, unmarried, and single households. The position of married is better than single. It's not just simple economics. The expectations put upon a child in a single home are different. One might claim it makes them grow up faster, a refutation of my central argument, but they do not. They grow up without structure, and the put-upon sole parent often lacks the energy and focus to provide necessary guardrails and discipline. Children seem to be free and innocent creatures, and in some ways they are, but they crave structure. They want to know that someone is in charge. Single parents often treat their children as companions and friends. There is no hierarchy, and that can be warping. The second new thing in our republic is the shrinkage of family size, though this is in and of itself not new. Augustus Caesar himself lamented such a thing millennia ago, creating laws to try and encourage both more Roman marriage and larger families. Today, China's President Xi, in a clear repudiation of the one-child policy per family rule instituted in the 1970s, is also trying to create larger families. However, whereas China's demographic issue was governmental, America's is more cultural. According to a recent study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a rapid worldwide demographic shift is expected to occur, which might affect the care economy moving forward. According to the study, family sizes are expected to shrink by 35% in the near future, which could upend the family structure and care economy for aging individuals and children alike. One of the most common explanations, and it seems fairly plausible, is that women entering the workforce choose to have children much later than previous generations, thus capping the number of children. Additionally, the accessibility and variety of contraceptives makes it much easier to regulate the having of children than in prior decades or centuries. Yet the problem with this conjecture is that smaller families are more of a 150-year trend than one from the last 50. The average number of people per household was 5.5 in 1850, then 4.5 in 1910, 4 in 1930. It was already 3.3 in 1960, and this year it is expected to be 2.6. So family size is much smaller than in the past, and as we have just seen, it is getting smaller still. Here's another interesting thing about these sort of factoids. If it gets below 2, that is replacement level. In other words, we might actually see populations shrink. Would this not mean that a harried parent can now devote more time to children? Two problems with that. First, the extra time enabled by less children means more focus on those children. Second, without siblings, the attention that a child does get is laser focus. And in a single parent household with a single child, there is something I call super onlys. The usual parent-child relationship is warped because the parent does not want a child necessarily, they want a companion, a friend. Even in an only child, in a two-parent household, that child must compete with the other spouse, but not in that single-parent environment. So we have seen family shrinkage. And I now want to take a quick moment for a digression to talk about the ultimate shrinking family situation. I had talked earlier about that one child per family policy instituted by the Communist Chinese Party all those years ago, some 50 to 60 years ago. Think about how this works. You have a set of parents who can only have one child, so they have a boy. You have another set of parents, they can only have one child, but in their case, they have a girl. Now, this boy and this girl eventually get together and they get married, but they too can only have one child. You now have six adults, two parents, and four grandparents, all focused on this single child. Who has the power in this relationship? Who is the laser focus of this? To whom is invested the hopes and dreams of six adults? Think about what it would be to be that child. And I don't think that's a good thing. No child should have the hopes and dreams of six other individuals invested in them. This is what happens with shrinkage of family. When two parents, let's say, have two kids, three kids, maybe even more than that, their investments then are spread across. Not any one child is this sort of sole power arbiter. Not any one child can control the family. And remember that these kids have to compete with their siblings, and they learn very interesting rules in that regard. Anybody who's grown up with brothers and sisters understands that you learn some basic skills like how to share, how to manage authority up or down, because usually the older children have a little bit more authority than the younger ones. You learn some really basic skills that these shrinkage families do not know. The next new trend is something that was foreign to the ancients and medieval, and only partially realized by most people in the world today, and that is leisure time. Getting to the 10-minute mark in any conversation is difficult before one of the parties proclaims how busy they are. But that depends on how you define busy. Before 160 years ago, when most people's drinking water was carried in from wells and buckets, food was not pre-made but garnered from raw wheat or chicken eggs. If the roof leaked, or the chimney was in disrepair, or the stove was broken, there was no one to call. You did it yourself. When your clothes ripped, you did not go to Walmart or Amazon and order a replacement. You fixed the clothes yourself. That life, which basically humanity existed in for about 4,800 years of written records, that was busy. Today, what is busy? According to Pew Research again, among employed U.S. adults aged 25 to 64 and married, husbands spend about 28 hours per week on leisure. It is a little less for women, but not much less. Americans spend over $80 billion on sports entertainment, tens of billions on video games, and nearly $60 billion on gambling. It is not as if the benighted American people are toiling in fields, working 6 days a week on 12-hour shifts in the glue factory, or sweating it out in coal mines. Comparisons to the elite of the Ming Empire, Romanov, Russia are inapt. For the great majority of the population, Americans have more choices about what to do with their time than generations of humanity have ever dreamed possible. So the argument is that with all this leisure, and remember, with shrinking families, there's less kind of focus on all kinds of different children. Cannot a parent spend more time establishing a genuine parent-child relationship? Time to provide that critical structure and discipline? Again, this extra leisure time in smart families do not lead to that establishment, but rather the time is used on maximizing little Susie's full potential. Psychologists have long warned that children's lives are overscheduled, undermining their ability to develop non-academic skills they'll need in adulthood, from coping with setbacks to building solid relationships. Now, a trio of economists say they've been able to calculate some of these psychological costs. In a new data analysis, published in the February 2024 issue of the Economics of Education Review, three economists from the University of Georgia and the Federal Reserve Board found that students are assigned so much homework and signed up for so many extracurricular activities that the last hour was no longer helping to build their academic skills. Instead, the activities were harming their mental well-being, making students more anxious, depressed, and angry. Parents should use this leisure time for unscheduled, impromptu activities, but now their lives are busy. Here is the critical change. The busyness is around the child, not around the parent, not around the family. And the fourth change is the government. About a dozen years ago, an Obama administration scheme equipped poor people with cell phones to encourage entry into the digital age. One woman clamorously screamed, "An Obama phone! An Obama phone!" In her mind, the phone came directly from the former president. Of course, her fellow taxpayers funded the project. To her, it was a gift from a beneficent president. Children rarely understand the process by which a parent goes to work, earns money, gives some of that money, let's say, to the grocery store, and brings home food. Like the Obama phone, the food appears to the infant like magic. One of the many pernicious effects of government is removing the cause and effect of how things are produced and consumed. Citizens are shielded from the costs. Thus, we have student debt cancellation, or the more odious term, God, I can't stand this one, forgiveness. What this really is not cancellation. It is not forgiveness. It is cost transference. On a certain level, Bernie Sanders understands the concept of transference. He just wrongly believes it should come from some nebulous, inhuman blob called the rich. The child, however, does not understand the economics. From their perspective, food, heat, clothes, and other goods simply appear. They do not consider the work, the pay, the purchase, or distribution. And what is happening increasingly is they are carrying that belief into adulthood. Food appeared when they were 6, and now phones appear when they are 36. The other stultifying effect of government is a trait of liberty, of choice, for a false veneer of security. This month, we have seen talk of shrinkflation. It is as if a grown adult cannot check a box, read a weight, or know which company is providing value and which is not. In this case, we're not asking people to do something complex like select an oncologist, but rather pick out a box of cereal. In the infantilization game, the master player is always someone like Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, or Kamala Harris, assuming they can run your life better than you can. The nanny state is a term that is meant to be pejorative, and yet that term is unerringly accurate. The problem is their charges in this case are not children, but adults. Again, because somebody is afraid of picking out that box that's half full, they feel like they need the security of the government to protect them. They do not. They are adults and capable of making that kind of choice. When we combine these four factors of single or transient parents, small families, leisure time devoted to children, and magical government support, we have the recipe for one of the most deleterious trends of our time and something unique to our current generation. The child is not only the center of the family, but in many regards, its ruler. Child kings, from King Tut to King Richard II to Henry VI of England, often make poor rulers and eventually poorer adults. As noted in the Save My Family blog, kids at any age aren't mentally capable of using their power wisely and for their own good. If they get everything they want, and they want it, this creates a deep sense of anxiety. An example would be if you were teleported from your comfy SUV to the cockpit of a Boeing 737 airplane and asked to land the thing. Your first reaction would be panic, followed by anxiety. You would not be qualified, trained, or have the professional maturity to do the job. The difference is that someone like me is old enough to know that I cannot pilot that plane. whereas kids usually can't make that distinction. That may not be the perfect analogy, but you get the idea. Kids crave reasonable and loving boundaries, limits, and guidance. And it's the job of the parents to put those in place. The best kinds of families are those where the marriage is at the center of it. The parents are at the center. So we have moved from that to child-centric families. And again, slowly starting to creep into child-ruled families. The result is increasingly reflected in two American phenomena. The first is the infantilization, or at best the juvenilization of our society. And the second, an outgrowth of that, is the desire on the part of too many Americans to wish to be the rebels, the revolutionaries, the ones who challenge the man, are part of the resistance, fighting the regime, and overturning the apple carts. After all, they have been feted, celebrated, enthroned, and enshrined from birth. Parents organize their schedules around the kids, not the other way around. The parent's best friend is not Ned the neighbor, Sal from the Elks Lodge, or Leroy from the Union Hall. It is little Billy. Morgan's best friend is her daughter Zoe, not her college roommate. And no best friend would be the most logical one of them all, their marital partner. Single and unmarried partnerships are flexible and transient. The relationship with their child is a permanent aspect of their lives, and in an era with few community or religious ties, and work from home now a staple, sometimes the only permanent social relationship is that of the parent with this child. Any child raised in this fashion often does not learn the word no. The word no is a parent's ally, but it is treated today as the enemy. The child gets to make all the decisions. When and where to talk, what foods that they can eat, what activities that they will decide to do, even as something as when to go to bed. They are in charge. Since they have no real sense of what an adult is, they fail to become one themselves. And because many children never see how married adults interact, they are ill-equipped to become one themselves. All of this means we are becoming a nation of Peter Pans, pushed to grow up early, but never really growing up at all. Peter, though God only knows how old he really was the rebel, pawing at authoritative figures. There is a reason why, in Peter Pan Productions, the same actor plays both Patriarch Mr. Darling and Captain Hook. They both represent the same thing, adulthood and authority. So when these children, who are used to running everything and ruling the family, actually come up against actual authorities, Their insistence is, again, to be the outsider, the rebel, and the resistance. Regardless of age, Americans are forever young at heart, or at least immature. Americans rarely serve in the military or experience true depredation, yet they parade around as if they were Spartacani fighting the Roman Empire for their liberty, William Wallace yelling freedom as he is disemboweled, Nathan Hale lamenting his only life to give, or the Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi. Of course, most of us are none of those things. This is the odd chemistry at work. Elizabeth Warren wants to run your life, which can only be achieved by controlling the levers of government, yet she thinks of herself as an outsider. The American people want to be heard on all manners of subjects, to live our best lives and to experience our own personal truths. Still, we disdain any sense that we ourselves can be stewards of our own experiences, shapers of our own destiny. How else to explain the support of our two leading presidential candidates conducting themselves like 12-year-olds? Though in Trump's case, a self-respecting tween would never stoop to the inane nicknames he has uncorked lately. And their followers act likewise. On January 6th, Trump expressed his disapproval and disagreement about the results of the 2020 election. Like an orange-haired Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka fame, he stomped his foot. "I want the presidency, Daddy, and I want it now." But he whined to a crowd who also disagreed with the results. So like a massive mobbish tantrum, these 180-pound toddlers threw a fit in our nation's capital. Mobs are always unreasonably infantile by nature, but this one was in America, and this attack had never happened before. And even before January 6th, we had the BLM riots. Bad things were done to people 150 years ago, or to a guy in Minneapolis. So I am justified in looting this store in Chicago? Wait, what? Maybe if we had handed out lollipops to the protesters, the rioting would have been abated. And has there been a politician less self-aware like the emo teen Joseph Biden? From his 1980s plagiarisms to his bluster at the Clarence Thomas hearings to his swearing at the Affordable Care Act signing ceremony, you could just see Obama cringe when Joe leaned in really close and, like a child that just learned a new cuss word, had to say it was a big effing deal. Biden forever has been that classic kid from the communal swimming pool, always yelling, look at me, as they do something very unextraordinary. And how about Biden's inability to do what every Democrat, heck, some of his Republicans, would beg him to do? Step down and let a new generation take over. Like a tempestuous two-year-old who just lost his Ted, the White House is mine. You can hear the Biden toddler scream. Trump routinely rails, or wails, might be more the more appropriate term, against the so-called elite. So let's look at Trump's bio. He was born to extremely wealthy, well-connected New York City real estate developer. He was sent to expensive private boarding schools. He attended an Ivy League university. He has built eponymously named buildings throughout the world. He hobnobbed with the rich and famous, well, and the infamous in the case of Jeffrey Epstein. He did cameos in TV shows and movies. He then hosted his own reality TV show on one of the largest networks owned by the largest cable company in America. Oh, and he was president of the United States. Trump is not of the elite. He is the elite of the elite. Yet it is he who screams about deep states and swamps and conspiracies as if he were not part of any of it. As if he was like Jimmy Stewart's rock-solid, honest Jefferson Smith trying to fight the man. A New York real estate billionaire who went to Penn and hosted a show on Comcast NBC is the man. Yet remember how I said Biden demands attention? Trump is the four-year-old who interrupts adults when they are talking, but no one corrects him. No one tells him to wait his turn. We are about to elect a man who does not need the White House. He needs a massive timeout, or better yet, a severe spanking. And we have other prominent political figures like the aforementioned Marjorie Taylor Greene and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In the latter case, her policy pronouncements of knowledge of her job after 6 years continues to sound like the eighth grader of who no teacher or parent said, sit down, learn something, and think before you speak. Here is the paradox. Like the 14-year-old who many on the left think is capable of determining their gender and deciding to have life-altering reproductive surgery, American children are in charge. Yet the irresponsible, imprudent authority being vested in our children creates a sense of anxiety and mental struggle. We have 20 and 30-somethings, and as I've illustrated, even 70 and 80-somethings, who simultaneously think they are the rebels struggling for liberty while ceding it at crucial points in their lives. They want to be adults when it suits them, but revert to childhood when faced with adversity. And who does that sound like? That is a definition of children. Though they are now adults, they are trapped in the psychology of wanting the advantages of choice, but not really desiring the accompanying responsibilities. They have been given the former, but not educated or formed to manage the latter. Children always act out against their parents. They are testing the bonds of responsibility and feeling their way towards eventual independence. But strong parents provide that safety net, the guardrails, and that word I've used before, the structure. A teen violates curfews, but is grounded when caught. Eventually, they will understand that the curfew is for their benefit, and when they are in charge of their own lives, they will not stay out until all hours. They become adults, not rebels. Imagine a 16-year-old, though, with no curfew. He can stay out until he likes, and so he can when 25, but does not understand the value of that parental prohibition. He will still look for those parents, though now call it the establishment, the man in the elite, and he will fail to discern a true leader from the grifter, as we have seen in 2024. He is a man-child and not ready for the world. The attitude of a child in an adult's body is a damning thing for men and women and for society as a whole. Thank you for listening to this latest Conservative Historian podcast. Check out all of our podcasts. We are up and down the dial, and we are on all the major systems. Once again, thanks for listening.